Thank you. We're going to stay on agenda here with our first speaker. Our first speaker this morning is the Associate Director of the Strategic Partnerships at the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks, where he leads efforts at further EERC's missions to provide practical pioneering solutions to the world's energy and environmental challenges. They are working to find ways to use fossil fuels through carbon capture and storage, and also how to increase the production for North Dakota's oil fields. Please welcome John Haryu.
I was telling a few folks earlier that I generally know better than to wear a suit and tie when I come here, because I do know it does erode my credibility considerably. But if it helps, I have a meeting with one of the interim committees of the legislature this afternoon, which I think it'll help my credibility there. So I don't know. I'm probably one of those guys that lacks credibility everywhere he goes. So, you know, maybe the coat is just a facade, right? I wanted to talk to you this morning about some work that we've been doing that we hope will substantially increase the productivity of this Bakken Reservoir as a function of time. So I'm not talking about something that we think would dramatically increase our daily rates on wells out here, but what I'm talking about is something that might turn this play from a 30 or 40 year play into a 70 or 80 year play. And I'm very confident that the work that we're doing is going to be very helpful in doing so. Is there a... And it moved. Okay. A program like this has been ongoing now for several years, and there are quite a number of millions of dollars that have flowed into this program. And there's a number of key sponsors of this work that one needs to stop and focus on for a moment, because without them, there's no way that we move these things forward the way that we have. And in particular, our oil and gas research program under the state's Industrial Commission has been a key sponsor of this work in its earliest phases, and most recently with a new financial award that facilitates keeping this work going. Also the Department of Energy, through the National Energy Technology Lab at the federal government, has been a key sponsor of this work since its inception as well. Equally important is the support of the companies that ultimately will be the folks that need to implement this thing in the field, namely Continental Resources, Marathon Oil, Hess Corporation, in terms of key producers, along with XTO Energy. We've also had Baker Hughes, Schlumberger, and the Computer Modeling Group, who are really the pioneers in commercial software for reservoir simulation, who have all acknowledged that they really don't have quality means of simulating the kinds of things that we're looking at in the subsurface, and are graciously providing their software and their people time to try to improve that software to facilitate realizations in digital media of things that we're observing in the laboratory that'll help us upscale the things that we're doing into the field. And then finally, Kinder Morgan, who started supporting this work about a year prior to their first real entree into the state through the purchase of the Highland gathering system. Again, about probably 6-7 months ago. But of note, Kinder Morgan is the world's largest supplier of carbon dioxide, and they currently supply well over a billion cubic feet a day of CO2 to oil fields in West Texas. So these are you know, the key financial supporters of this work. Similarly, I see Mr. Helms in the back here. He's been very encouraging and helpful from the inception of this work, as have his staff at the Geological Survey, and the North Dakota Petroleum Council has also been extremely helpful to this program. So, I have to occasionally make sure that I'm on track here. So the Bakken Formation is a tight oil formation, so it has extremely low permeability, less than a tenth of a millidarcy, which probably doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot to the non-reservoir people here, but I'm going to give you a little bit better sense of what that looks like with some SEM photographs and some other charts here shortly. But these tight oil formations are found around the world. They're usually associated with organic rich shales. In some places, people try to produce, and this is typically in gas, but some try to produce directly from the shales. But much of this tight oil production really comes from adjacent rocks, and certainly in the Williston Basin here, what we tend to do is try to produce from the Middle Bakken, which is not a shale, or from the upper Three Forks. Finally, the fluid flow in these reservoirs is really dominated by the natural fracture systems that are there in the rocks as they reside in the subsurface, and also, and probably more importantly, those fractures that we induce in the formation by subjecting them to high pressure on the injection, so the hydraulic fracturing. So it's a cartoon of the Bakken petroleum system. I know Mr. Helms has probably showed you his picture of the Oreo cookie, and I think that's a great depiction. And in this case, the two black areas there on the slide would really illustrate the hard part. And the thing is all of those other colors in between the two black areas would be, you know, that single creamy part, which we've been very focused on trying to discern subtle differences throughout that filling in the Oreo cookie. So turns out from our perspective, there's a bunch of Nutter Butters and some chocolate chips and there's a whole bunch of other stuff in between, which makes this even more complicated as we step forward. And when we look at them in pictures, you know, we start to elucidate what these subtle differences between the rocks within that Middle Bakken system. So across the top of the chart here, you have the two real dark ones are the shales themselves, and then there are what we think are five distinct what we call lithofaces, which, because geologists can't use simple words, we make things up from their Latin roots. Really what that means is, you know, rock types. So, but there's five very distinct types of rocks that we see in those Middle Bakken layers, and producers are very adept at chasing very specific of those lithofaces because of the production characteristics that they will ultimately provide. So in the horizontal legs of these wells, we're often chasing one or more of those specific Middle Bakken lithofaces, depending on where we are in the basin. And then finally, there's some pictures of those Three Forks rocks as well. So you see the very substantial differences when we look at these things much more closely. Well, when we look at them under so somehow these are different order on the piece of paper I have. So I'm going to go back to this one. What you're looking at here is what we call doesn't matter what we call it. What this is a graphical representation of the typical pore throat sizes in a series of rocks. On the top left is a conventional reservoir in Bell Creek, Montana. And what you're looking at is each bar represents a percentage of pores out of a total, so they'll always total 100%, and the size of those pores. And what you see is these pores tend to be of a particular size that allows us to readily move fluids through them. The top right is what we call the seal on that very same conventional reservoir. So the whole top half of the slide is a conventional reservoir in Bell Creek, Montana, currently undergoing a CO2 EOR project. The EERC is very deeply involved in this thing with a company called Denbury Resources. Well, what you see when you compare those rocks with the ones on the bottom half, which are Bakken rocks, is that the very rocks we want to do CO2 EOR on in this Bakken system actually have a very similar set of characteristics to what we consider the seal rocks in that Bell Creek field. In essence, this Bakken system is very, very difficult to move fluids through, which is, of course, why we hydraulically fracture it. When we look at that under magnification, and this is the same magnification, it's a 250 times the image, you start to see what that really means. The picture on the left is that muddy formation, which would be the equivalent of our Dakota system here. The lighter parts are the rocks, and the dark parts are the porosity. And so you can imagine how easy it is to move fluid through that porosity. The ones on the right are the top, the middle Bakken, where we currently produce oil, and the one on the bottom, the Bakken, little lower Bakken shale, which we don't really produce directly from today. But you see this obvious contrast between the rocks and their fabric. So as a backdrop, today we're approaching about a 13,000 well inventory here in North Dakota on this Bakken Three Fork system, producing about 1.2 million barrels of oil a day and about 1.65 billion cubic feet of gas a day. And virtually all of these wells are hydraulically fractured and tend to be long horizontals. So the focus of our work over the course of this has been, how much bigger can this Bakken system get? So again, we had that 1.2 million barrels a day. Can we extend that for longer and longer periods of time has been one of our key focal points. So right now, we estimate that really only about 5% of that oil in place is actually being recovered with the current technology that we're utilizing. And what we want to do is change that, and change that in a meaningful way. Obviously, small improvements, a percent here or there, translates into a whole lot of oil. And in particular, can CO2 be a game changer in this? At the same time that we're looking to try to lift our Bakken recovery factors, as a nation, the federal government is obsessed with trying to capture CO2 and do something with it other than emit it to the atmosphere because of concerns over climate change. And so this is one of these, can we take these lemons, turn them into lemonade, and that's the kind of thing that we're focused on here. The graphic that you're looking at there is an evolution over time of our estimates of how big this Bakken petroleum system is. And I think that the key take-home message, we don't know exactly how much oil there is in the system. It's somewhere in the hundreds of billions to maybe as much as a trillion barrels of oil. But the small orange dots illustrate what we consider our technically recoverable portion. So you see that challenge that we have of getting more of that oil out of the ground. Just how big might it be? We currently have two means of estimating what the EOR potential is that are rigid and consistent with assessments others have done in the literature. So the first of which is a simple means of trying to extrapolate how much more you can produce in an EOR project by projecting forward from a production base. Because we're so early in the production of this Bakken resource, our belief is that that's going to give us extremely skewed low results, because we've only recovered such a small portion of the resource so far. But that number gives us somewhere in the neighborhood of about 500 million barrels incremental that we wouldn't recover otherwise if we were using CO2. And that would take somewhere between 120 and almost 200 million tons of CO2 to achieve. As a point of reference, today, all of our stationary sources here in the state of North Dakota that generate power currently emit about 33 million tons of CO2 a year, and tons are kind of weird to think of as a in a gas phase, but at the end of the day, what we do is we compress this CO2 into a dense phase for injection in the ground. So that's why we use terms like tons, also because it gets into a whole heck of a lot of cubic feet when we try to, you know, measure it that way. If we take a different approach to this, which I think is still conservative, yet at least gives us the right flavor of how big this thing can be, it's an approach based on estimates of that original oil in place. And so, remember I said that maybe in the hundreds of billions to maybe as much as a trillion barrels of oil, we come up with an estimate of somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 or 3 billion tons of CO2 are going to be necessary. The high end of that would be about 100 years of all CO2 from all coal-fired generation here in the state would be necessary to achieve this potential, and that it would yield on the order of 4 to 7 billion incremental barrels of oil, which is a huge thing as we think about that from our state's perspective, all of the tax revenue, all of the good jobs, and again, that this wouldn't happen in a contemporaneous time frame, but rather would extend the life of this reservoir over many more decades. Sounds great. Well, it's a little bit challenged. I showed you the pictures of those rocks and the challenges with the fabric, and how do we move CO2 through those rocks? Well, these are a handful of the challenges that we're trying to address through this research program and with the support of the state and the federal government and the companies that are working with us. But in essence, when we induce fractures or hydraulically fracture this reservoir, what we create is a very substantial contrast between those induced fractures and that matrix where most of that oil really is. And in essence, we inject CO2, it moves very quickly through that fracture system and doesn't really interact with the fabric of the rock where the oil is. And there's been several attempts at pilot projects already in the state that really have not been economically successful. That being said, they are instructive. And while they weren't successful, as they inform our laboratory work continues to show great promise for this, and so that's why we're busy. That's why we continue to have the support of these companies and our state and federal government. And there's a whole handful of other things that we see are challenges, but that's really one of the primary ones. And I'll also just mention that, in particular, water flooding is not something that we think is going to be widely effective in this Bakken system. As we look at most of our Madison reservoirs, Red River reservoirs, et cetera, around the state, most of them after a good, healthy lifetime in primary production where we're just simply lifting fluids from the reservoir and depleting reservoir pressure, that we can, in good fields, we can go and start injecting water and sweeping incremental oil to our producers. We really don't believe that that's going to be effective at all in this Bakken system because of the nature of the rocks. We find that the rocks in the Bakken system tend to be what we call oil wet, which means that the wetting fluid on the interstitial pore spaces it has a thin film of oil on it. In a conventional reservoir, they tend to have a thin film of water on it, and so the oil is residing on top of a water film, and when we push water across that, it tends to sweep it off of it because like molecules. When we use water in Bakken system, what we fear is that the water is going to simply push that oil deeper into the pores rather than sweep it from the system. So, I won't dwell on this much, but this is from some colleagues at the Colorado School of Mines that have been focused on the physics of how pore sizes ultimately affect fluid behavior. And so, again, I don't think it's notable to dwell on it much, because I do have a couple of movies that I want to show you that I think will help you visualize what happens when we mix CO2 with Bakken oil. I think that's a very exciting and much more instructive way to understand how this might work. So in essence, you know, this cartoon illustrates that matrix, which is those buff areas, and the little red dots are supposed to indicate oil molecules that are sitting in that matrix, and the fractures are obviously the white area moving through there. But we have a whole series of techniques that we utilize in the laboratory to try to better understand the nature of the rocks, the fluids within them, and how things are transported from one to the next. The cartoons, as you look over toward the right half of the screen, what you see are some arrows moving in and out, and this is the way we believe things are going to happen as we inject CO2. So we inject CO2, it rapidly fills up these fractures, and initially it starts to permeate into that matrix. As it starts to permeate into that matrix, it actually may move additional oil into the matrix, but at some point you create enough of a concentration within that matrix that you have a net movement out of the matrix into the fractures that we can now manipulate and try to move toward a producing well. So there's a number of places within the basin here that we've been focused on, that we have done detailed work on cores, and they're illustrated on this map. There are several where field tests have already been conducted. And again, as I said, they're really not technically successful, but they're certainly instructive. And here's what we think, you know, we've learned, you know, as a departure point for much of this work, is that, you know, really the movement of the fluids both in and out of the system really relies on the fractures. You know, microfractures, so those that are inherent in the rocks prior to us ever trying to get into the system and produce it, really account for most of the productive porosity across all of the Bakken system, whether it's the shales or whether it's the Middle Bakken or whether it's the Three Forks. Generating data on those fracture systems and integrating them into the modeling is really essential to developing a high-quality EOR concept. And again, these are just some pictures that allow us to allow you and us to better visualize. And one of the things that we do as we look at these, by characterizing the things that we see within the fractures, they help us understand whether they're actually induced or whether they're native. If we see minerals that have precipitated on the faces of those fractures, we know they've been there for a very long time, as opposed to something that happened when we collected the core or when we manipulated it in the laboratory. I'm going to skip these because I did those, I think, pretty well with that prior cartoon. So in terms of what have we been doing in the laboratory, so Vicki said, can you come give us a talk about the chiclets? So I don't want to talk about the chiclets. I want to talk about the rods. So in any event, what we do is we take these cores, we cut them into small pieces, we put them in that little cell, and what you're looking at there, there's coins there to give you some sense of the scale. And we essentially immerse that piece of core into high pressure, high temperature carbon dioxide, and we start to look at what comes out of them. Now, in some cases, these are pieces of core that have been sitting in the core library for years. They're dry to the touch. They might smell a little bit of oil, but if you put water on them, the only thing that happens is you get little beads of water on the surface of these things. But if you stick them in this little cell, immerse them in high temperature and high pressure CO2, something very different happens. We take them up to about 5,000 pounds per square inch in these little cells, and about 110 degrees C, or about 235, 240 degrees Fahrenheit, and observe. And here's the kind of elution profile that we're able to achieve with those rocks. And at the top, where most of those graphs tend to be petering out, is that's at 100% of the oil within those rocks coming out in that CO2 bath. Now, if you contrast that with what I've said we're achieving in the reservoir right now, it's about 5%. Now, I'm also not going to sit here and tell you that we'll ever get 100% of that oil out of those rocks, but I am pretty comfortable that we might get 12 or 14 or something like that over time, especially as we continue to increase this knowledge. And it doesn't matter whether it's Middle Bakken rocks, it doesn't matter if it's shales, it doesn't matter if it's Three Forks. These are all on a percentage basis, and when we look at the shales, it's actually more oil, because there's more oil in the shales. It's a percent of what's there. There tends to be about three times as much oil in the shales as there are in the adjacent rocks. And depending on which company and which petroleum engineer you're talking to, you have a varying degree of confidence that we're currently producing any oil from the shales at all. So some guys will say, nah, we only produce from the middle and from Three Forks. And some guys say, well, we're getting some from the shales themselves. Obviously, our wells are in the Middle Bakken, and they're in the Three Forks, but there's considerable debate about how much contribution of oil produced from those wells actually comes from the shales themselves. And what's really exciting about this work is we're very confident if we can get CO2 into those shales, we can get oil out of those shales. And obviously, when we're simply immersing it in a bath like that, we're getting CO2 in because oil is coming out. So now it's an engineering problem. We've also developed our own technique. There's a patent pending on this technique to measure a parameter that we call minimum miscibility pressure or multi-contact miscibility pressure. But this is a reservoir term, and most engineers are used to looking at some kind of a plot like you see there, a graphic of pressure versus something. In this case, it's a capillary rise. But in essence, what we've done is a method where we take a movie of the oil as it interacts with CO2, and we set a series of capillary tubes, that's the lower photo that you see there, and we just simply measure the height in those tubes until we've reached, it's a very simple technique, of course, as somebody once told me, you know, the KISS principle, right? Keep it simple, stupid. We can physically measure a point where we have zero interfacial tension or any means by which that oil is trying to climb up a capillary tube. So what we're trying to do is rigidly identify a specific, physically reproducible experiment that tells us when we don't have interfacial tension, that allows us to better ascertain at what pressure in the reservoir that oil is going to start to behave differently than it does. And the next thing I'm going to do is show you a movie of what exactly that looks like. Okay, so what we're doing is increasing the pressure in this cell. The little blue line indicates what the ambient level of oil in that thing was. The red line at 315 pounds of pressure. And what you see is that oil is swelling now as we're introducing CO2 into the top of it. And you're going to get to a point where the minimum miscibility pressure for this oil of about 2,800 has been exceeded. And what you see is the oil seems to be disappearing, but what's happening is it is becoming a single phase with that carbon dioxide in the upper part of the cell, which is in a less dense phase, less viscous, and in turn more mobile. Now we're reducing the pressure, and what you see is as we reduce pressure, the CO2 or the oil is falling out of that CO2 phase. And so there's this really dynamic behavior of oil and CO2 in the reservoir, and we're able to visualize it with these techniques that we've built. Now what happens in a real reservoir, if you think about it, is we increase the pressure, by injecting CO2. It starts to interact with that oil. Ideally, we're mobilizing that oil, moving it to somewhere else in the reservoir. But if we reduce that pressure to what it may have been depleted to, it just simply goes into that less mobile phase again. And we've helped a number of companies in conventional reservoirs by looking at movies that span this production profile of what they're doing in a reservoir of, okay, we mobilize oil, but somehow they're operating a lifting system at a point of production at very, very low pressures. And what we start to see is oil that was mobilized becoming less mobile. I'm not going to show you another movie because I don't want to delve into it. But what this picture illustrates, the little dip tube at the top of the screen there, is this a pointer? That little thing allows us to sample the oil or the phase that is mobilized. And so what we've done now is start to look at the differences in chemistry between the liquid oil in the bottom of the cell and the oil that we mobilize, and what we find is CO2 actually selectively mobilizes certain fractions of the oil. And the crazy thing that happens in some reservoirs, and this is one of the first really commercial things that we've done with this technique, is helped a company understand that they were depositing asphaltenes or very heavy immobile fractions of oil right near their production wells in a big EOR flood, which in turn was inhibiting their ability to produce oil at all. So they were very disappointed with their flood. What we asked them to do was reduce their lifting rates on their production profiles, back flush a little bit of CO2 in those existing wells. We were able to remedy this and bring that performance back online. But it's the kind of thing that you wouldn't typically find with a more traditional miscibility pressure assessment. By taking these movies, we can actually visualize things, and by doing the analytical work within the phase and looking at the individual components within the oil, we're able to learn much, much more. So, another movie I'm not going to show you. So what we do is we try to take all of these things that we've learned in the field, and you remember I mentioned that we're also working with all of these guys that develop these great software packages that help us simulate what happens in the reservoir when we inject something like CO2 at high pressure and temperature. And so we build these models, and they're getting better every day, especially with the help of these companies. And then we upscale them to the point that we start to stick wells into the system, and then we start introducing CO2 based on those models, and try to look at much, much cheaper ways to do tests than actually bringing CO2 out to the field and putting many, many millions of dollars on each pilot project into things where we can run hundreds or thousands of realizations at a time with models that we've built, and try to zero in on things that we think are going to be more effective. We've looked at a variety of either huff and puff or injector producer schemes. At this point, like I say, thousands of realizations that we've been able to do with these systems. In many cases, we see very reasonable improvement, and in some cases, over 100% improvement. So from that, let's say, 5% to 10%, which is really, really exciting when we're looking at that from an economic case. We also see that the production response is substantially delayed when we can compare it to conventional reservoirs like the Bell Creek one that we've been working in, which makes sense when you consider the physics and the nature of the fabric of the rocks, like I showed you earlier. So the simulations are great, but what happens when we try to take this out into the field? Well, as I'd alluded to earlier, there are public records regarding five tests that have been done in North Dakota, and one that's been done over in Elm Coulee. The Elm Coulee test was a CO2 test. Two of the companies that are deeply engaged with us in this work have been able to provide information from that test to us, and we've been able to sort back through things that have been learned there. There are two that were done in North Dakota, and there've been some water tests, and then there's one water test that was followed by field gas or gas prior to gathering, or that may have otherwise gone to a flare. So what have we learned from those field tests? Well, we can inject CO2 into the system. Some people questioned whether you could even inject. Unfortunately, what we've learned is that you're largely injecting it into those fractures, and they tend to run away from your matrix. But we've also seen that we can influence production somewhat. So we have seen bumps in oil production in those tests that have been done, not economically, but what that also tells us is we can influence the movement of oil in the reservoir with injected fluids like CO2. We also know that the improvements to date, that have been predicted by the models really haven't been observed. And again, I mentioned we've got all of the, there's only really three companies that produce models that are meaningful in this space. All three of them are working with us on this. And clearly, there's this big gap between what we can model and what reality is in the field. So our current modeling efforts, again, in conjunction with these guys, is to upscale all of these things that we're learning in the laboratory with some really cool techniques that I haven't even bothered to show you today about medical technology for CT scanners that allow us to rotate samples and visualize how those pores and microfractures are or are not interconnected, and build better and better and better models that give us better and better and better simulations. This is one picture of one of those CT scans of Bakken rocks. And by having a better picture of it allows us, and better measurements, it allows us to, again, build these better models that allow us to do a better job ultimately in the field, and ultimately have better injection and production schemes that allow us to be successful. So I'm going to summarize the accomplishments that we have to date. We have this new method for measuring miscibility pressure on oil samples. Notable is that instead of months, we can do it in hours, and we reduce the cost for companies to do this substantially, but allows us to do multiple replicates very quickly. And it's not just CO2. We've also been doing some really exciting work with rich field gas, ethane, and others. CO2 is a great baseline for us, but we have other working fluids that we're confident, and our miscibility pressure method works for those other fluids as well. We've demonstrated in the lab, at least, that CO2 can effectively permeate and remove oil from not only the Middle Bakken, but also the shales. We've looked extensively at core from 13 individual wells, detailed characterization as part of this package that's been pulled together. We've looked at those five field-based injection tests, and we've evaluated them collectively with respect to all of those lessons that have been learned. We've been constructing models at the drill spacing unit level, near the well bore, and all the way back to core plugs in conjunction with the partners. We've got many scenarios that we've looked at on one particular drill spacing unit, and we have a particular scheme that we think works really well. We call it our sequential multi-well injection production. But in essence, where we would be injecting and producing on a rotating basis in each of the particular wells in one of these multi-well spacing units. So we'd inject in let's say 3 of 14 wells, and for 1 month, the next month it'd be in three others, and what we'll be producing back. So essentially what we're trying to do is get that CO2 to stay within that system and work with the rocks that we want it to work with, as opposed to racing away from us, which has been a common challenge. Some take-homes I want to leave you with, that these unconventional resources are going to take an unconventional approach to enhanced recovery. We think diffusion is really far more important than displacement, which makes sense. Again, if you think about those photomicrographs that I showed you, you can see yourself pushing something through that highly interconnected porosity between the grains. You see the challenges from that CT image that I showed you with these widely disconnected pore spaces and disconnected droplets of oil. We think patience is going to be necessary, but we also are confident that the reward is going to be very substantial. I mentioned the sequential multi-well injection production concept. We also are fairly confident at this point that unfractured wells may be a very ideal situation for injection to try to, again, get past that stark contrast between fracture permeability and matrix permeability. We also think about injectors in the shale itself, paired with producers in the Middle Bakken and or the Three Forks. I think a great way to think about this, I was discussing it with a traffic engineer, and he essentially said, well, so these fractures are basically like your controlled access highways. And the matrix is like all these neighborhoods, and we can move a lot of stuff down these highways, but we just can't really get people on and off the highways into the matrix. And I think that's a great analogy. I mean, it's these fractures are very, very permeable. The rocks themselves aren't. What we need to do is figure out ways to get people out of those neighborhoods, onto those highways, and onto the places where they're productive. And of course, the people are molecules of oil. Okay. We need to understand the reservoir. We're building techniques every day to do that. We're working with our partners to do so. The existing modeling and simulation packages are being upgraded to accommodate the things that we're seeing in the lab. We're going to be doing a multi-zone injection test in a Bakken reservoir. We're currently discussing field plans with three different producers about exactly how to go about that, and things like everything in this oil, low oil price system are challenged, but the commitment of these producers to work with us and to try to keep moving this ball remains there. So we're confident we'll be in the field with a meaningful test fairly soon. And with that, I'd like to answer any questions that you might have, and I know I've blown through a few million bucks and a few years worth of work in about 45 minutes here, but hopefully it gives you something to think about in terms of some really exciting new news that's emerging as we speak, and I think is, again, going to be a real game changer on this resource as a function of time, and turn this thing into a multi-generational resource as opposed to one that might be only a couple of generations worth of work. Yes, sir.
What is rich field gas?
Oh, rich. Typically at our homes, the natural gas that comes to our house would be about 1,000 BTUs per standard cubic foot. And that's what comes out of a gas processing facility and moves all over the United States through the interstate transportation system. This Bakken gas tends to come out of the ground somewhere around 1,500 BTUs per standard cubic foot. And the difference between that 1,500 BTU gas and 1,000 BTU gas are these things we call natural gas liquids. So things like propane, butane, pentane. And depending on who you're talking to, ethane or not ethane, whether it's an NGL or whether it's not. But that's the difference. And so rich field gas would be something that hasn't had those constituent NGLs removed from it, which frankly works much, much better as a miscible fluid in the reservoir. Methane doesn't tend to mix well with oil until you get to extremely high pressures. But things like ethane actually have a much lower miscibility pressure with oil than CO2 does even. So we're really excited about rich gas as a working fluid as well. Great question. Yes, sir.
When you inject the CO2 underground, does it
What happens initially is most of it just is lost to the formation initially. Eventually, you create enough of a working volume once it's starting to affect that oil that it's actually co-produced with the oil. We separate it back out and re-inject it. So, initially, in a conventional reservoir, and so now we're really getting out there on a limb of, okay, 30 years into a Bakken EOR project, what's it going to look like? But I think eventually it starts to look more like a conventional project in maturity than it does in its inception. In the Bell Creek field today, we've been injecting for about 2.5 years with Denbury. For the first, about 10 months, we produced no CO2 back. But once we started to produce some oil, we'd start to get some CO2 as well. At that point, all of the recycling facilities were available on site, and the CO2 is essentially scrubbed from the oil, reinjected, because it's a very substantial cost of the operation as well. Probably one other key thing to note about these kinds of projects is typically you're in the hundreds of millions to low billion type dollars to get the project off the ground. In essence, securing the supply, getting the pipelines built to the facility, getting those recycling facilities available and so on. And so you're looking at a project that's very different than a conventional Bakken project where we drill the well, incur some substantial cost up front, but they pay back very quickly because they produce that oil so quickly. These EOR projects, you have all of that massive capital up front, and it often is several years before you even see positive cash flow from the project itself. However, they're the kinds of things that tend to last, like I said, decades. There are fields that have been undergoing continuous CO2 flooding in West Texas for more than 30 years now. So they're really great projects when you think about it from a long-term cash flow and employment and the kinds of things that we like to see here in the state. Yes, sir. I don't think that this would be every single well, but I think this is the kind of thing that at least in the heart of the basin, that each of these drill spacing units may have potential. So it may be a couple few wells per 16 or something like that. One more? Yeah, so there's currently, as most you're aware, there's about 2 million tons a year of CO2 moving from Beulah up to the Weyburn field in southern Saskatchewan. So that's volumetrically how much has been going up there. The field's been very successful. It's been an absolutely great EOR project. I don't have off the top of my head, daily rates and so on, but what I can say is it has exceeded the expectations of the company that operates it now, Synovus, previously Pan-Canadian, and I don't remember the other one, sorry, but Synovus is the current operator. But yeah, very successful project in a conventional reservoir, equivalent of what would be our Madison Formation or Mission Canyon. Great question. There is one. I can take another. I don't want to disrupt your. Yes, sir. Another great question. What we're really hoping is that this technology can ultimately help us finance CO2 capture projects on our existing coal-fired fleet, but also helping get us a whole new generation of coal-fired power in the state that provides the CO2 for this kind of work. And in essence, if you think about the nation and whether you believe in climate change or not, it sort of doesn't matter. We have this preconception that we're going to capture and manage CO2 or not emit it or whatever it is, right? I look at this in terms of, is this going to be just a cost? Is this going to be something that hurts us? Or can we make, again, take these lemons, turn them into lemonade? And in essence, we've got about an 800-year supply of coal at present mining rates right here in the state. I would like to continue that, and I think this is the kind of thing where if we can provide a positive economic return that supports that capture, while we generate additional revenue and generate additional productivity out of these out of this Bakken system, great. Let's make it work. But great question. We need a lot of CO2.